Distro hopping, the idea that Linux is fun and the myriad ways people put distros together should be reviewed often. My name is Moss. I live in Eastern Tennessee.
I'm Dale. I live in Northeast Ohio.
And I'm Eric. I live in Southwestern Florida.
Welcome to Distro Hoppers Digest. We love checking distros out, new distros, new versions of older distros, and even some we may have overlooked.
We each have our preferences in complexity or desktop or package management. Perhaps we can help you find a new distro or better understand one that has piqued your curiosity.
The idea of this podcast is that we each install a new distro to our chosen hardware for 3 to 4 weeks and use it as much as possible, perhaps even as our daily driver. We record all of our trials, tribulations, fixes, and what we like and what we don't.
I tend to take on the more advanced distros and give them a go.
While I tend to prefer looking at distros that would be kind to a new user, especially one who is hoping to move over from another operating system, such as Windows or macOS.
We intend to give as much information as possible on each distro, and we will also mention what hardware we are using and might comment on how we think the hardware may affect the rating.
Welcome to Distro Hoppers Digest, episode 51, recorded on the 30th of March, 2024. For this show, we will be reviewing Bunsen Lab Linux Boron and KDE Neon User Edition featuring the recently released KDE Plasma 6. Moss will not be joining us for this episode. Monthly Foibles, wherein we discuss what we did this month. I had an unplanned extra 11 days off due to my employer's truck being repaired, so I was quite busy around home. This is also one of the reasons the podcast is a bit late, since I wanted to work an extra week to make up for the lost work I had. My friend Pat has a VPS, which is a virtual private server, where he hosts websites. He created an account for me to host a website that I've been wanting to create. It's only been a few years since I've registered the domain. It is a WordPress site, except he is using a different templating system called Oxygen Builder. It is much nicer than the one that is in WordPress, but it did have quite a learning curve. I had dived into this a couple years ago when I first tried to get into it, but I forgot most of it since then. I had a lot more free time with my truck being in the shop, so I was able to watch the tutorial videos and read their great documentation again, and I must say, it is really nice documentation. I'm hoping to have it ready during the week I'm home, though most likely it'll continue to be a work in progress once I learn new-to-me features and other tweaks. I will need to export what I have on ItzMoss and import it into my new site, which I do see that option in WordPress, but I don't know if it's something anyone's ever tried before, because I've tried looking it up online, and I haven't seen anyone mention it, and my friend, who manages websites as a hobby once he retired a couple years ago, he's never done it, so it's going to be a new experience, and I will report back how it works or doesn't. I did some more work on my main server. I replaced Debian with TrueNAS Scale, which is based on Debian. Despite how I prefer using the command line to do administrative tasks, I do like the web GUI they are using. My friend Josh helped me with installing and configuring the containers for Plex and TailScale, since I don't want to say begrudgingly using the containers. I just wanted to see what all the hype is about. And even though I'm not creating the containers, I at least can see the orchestration behind them, and I do see their benefits. I later installed Nextcloud on my own after watching a YouTube tutorial on it from, I think, Lawrence Systems. He had a pretty good one. Tom does some good videos. I still need to configure it, but at least it's running, and I updated it earlier in the week, and it was very slow at deploying, that's the word. It was like 4 times slower than the other ones, but you have to remember how many databases and other stuff are running in the background there. So I forgot to sign out of my Plex server when I wiped the SSD that my previous Plex box was using. Oops. Long story short, there are instructions on how to remove it from the account after the fact. I, among others, had trouble getting them to work. Oddly, I also had trouble adding my new server to my account. Plex claims you can have multiple servers on one account. That proved otherwise in my experience. I used another account and my Plex Pass was going to expire, so I'll lose a few months out of that, but I'll just add it to the new account. I've been paying for that for like 14 years. And
yeah, me too.
I get benefit out of it. People always ask me why I'm not using Jellyfin or anything else. And I'm like, I'm pragmatic. I got 350 some movies, about a dozen TV shows. I don't want to do that all over again.
Yeah, I hear you. Same here. I like Plex. You know, I like the way it works and I have no problem supporting them because I've been with them before they even had Plex Pass, you know. I will say that the experience of the server is a lot different on Linux just simply because of all of the permissions and networking structure. It's just a different setup and it is definitely more involved if you have storage remotely on a different system versus everything just on the same server. That's caused me some problems over the years getting the Samba shares to work properly. But outside of that, it just always works. Yeah, that's why I like Plex.
Yeah, I tried doing the NFS before in the past, but I just didn't have the tuning foo to get it performant as Samba, because I see these YouTube videos where these guys are like, yeah, I'm getting 980 megabits off of this Samba server on this gigabit connection. I'm like, how? I get like 113. That's about as much as I get on the Samba.
Most of my stuff is just from DVD. I upscale it to 1080p, but still, it's not like the files are so big that I need, you know, they're not 4K or stuff like that. So
yeah, mine are all DVD rips. Yeah.
Yeah, it works fine.
I mentioned I had a tail scale container. This was a suggestion from my friend Josh. He has been using it for quite a while, so I decided to try it. I haven't had a remote access ability in my network for close to 10 years. I couldn't believe how easy the initial installation was. Adding a computer to the account is very simple. The only issues I have is with the DNS settings, but I'm thinking it's more of a me problem. They provide their own DNS to resolve the host names they create, and I think they grep that from the host name of the machine or some other type of metadata that's given. That works fine, and I'm able to connect with no problem using their DNS names. I wanted to use the exit node to try that out, which requires external DNS. It allows you to access the internet as if you're connected locally to a network. So it's basically like using Surfshark and Mulvad type of thing. You're rolling your own. Of course, your exit node is always at your residence. So I wanted to use my Pi-hole since it's already running on my local network. It seems fine for resolving hosts outside of my network, but I can't resolve the hosts on my local network, and I just haven't had the time to dig into that yet. I'm sure it is a tail scale setting, or like I said, a local computer setting. Overall, I'm pretty impressed with it. I'm able to connect to my servers and update them while I'm on my downtime at work. My friend Pat was wanting a better way of accessing his own local network. I told him about it over the phone, and he installed it while I was talking to him because he started asking me questions. And I'm thinking, wow, he's really getting into it. He must be reading the verbiage off the website. And then I find out he's actually installing it because he's another computer geek. So now he can use his VNC after connecting via his Tailscale without needing to open the ports because he got a new modem and he hadn't configured the firewall settings again. And he didn't like doing all that stuff anyways. And when I told him about the Tailscale, he was like, I got to try this. So he's happy with it and he's waiting for me to learn more about it so I can teach him. I've been wanting to use pfSense for a while. I used its predecessor about 10 years ago. I think it was called Smoothwall or something like that. The computer I wanted to use is a Pertelli Vault FW4B. It is a four-port computer similar to the size of my Lenovo ThinkCentre Tinies, though the Pertelli is designed for use as a router or a virtualization server. I've been holding off on it due to its price. Brand new, it is $250 without any memory or storage. I always end up finding something else to buy instead of it because I keep forgetting about it. I decided for now that I would use my previous Plex server. It is a Xeon E3 1231 V3, which I know is overkill for a router, especially for the internet speed that I have. You could probably route 100 gigabits of that thing. It has been fine and replaced my Unify security gateway that I was using for no reason other than, like I said, I wanted to try the pfSense for a change. The Xeon will eventually be the server that is going to be for my backups. The Scale server will back up to it, so I will have copies of data on two servers, along with an external hard drive and my online backup, plus any of that that may be on my various computers. It is still overkill for that task, but doesn't cost me anything except for the electric. And speaking of electric, I switched providers. Here in the States, you have the incumbent provider, which owns the lines that go down the street and connect to your house or apartment building. And then you have the generation or the energy suppliers. And that can be a different one. Well, my rate will now be about 5 or 6 cents per kilowatt hour. That is about half of what I was paying before. I didn't read the fine print when I moved here because of some of the other things going on. That provider was using a variable kilowatt per hour weight.
I honestly have no idea what I pay. That made me want to check now that you're saying 5 to 6 cents per kilowatt hour. And, you know, in the incumbent, I'm pretty sure the entire state of Florida is FPL, Florida Power and Light. I did use a different generation company for a while because they did more solar and wind and stuff. And I was trying to encourage investment in those technologies. But I know for a fact it was at least double, if not like triple, what FPL was charging. And so at some point when I had to tighten the purse strings, I kind of said, can't keep doing that.
Yeah, I changed to this one because that's what my friend had changed over because he had mentioned that to me a few months ago, that his was up to like 18, 20 cents. And I think mine was like 12. We're both using Ohio Edison because they own all they're the incumbent here. But I am now using, I think, AEP, which I think they're out of Columbus, Ohio. I think I can't remember. They start next month in April. The last billing for the other one is for March. So the last two things I will mention is my network redesign. I bought a smaller network rack so that I could put my servers on the bottom of my entertainment stand. There is so much more room on the bottom for them. My previous rack was too tall to fit on the upper level. I did a lot of cable organizing. Now when I need to move the entertainment stand from the wall, the cables are attached to the back and not hanging loose, so there's no chance of them getting pinched or pulled. Something I've been wanting to do for a while because you can't see what's behind there to see it's a spaghetti monster, but I know it's back there, so now I know it's not. Lastly, Pat wanted to improve his Wi-Fi. He replaced his cable TV boxes and his cable modem, for that matter, with a streaming stick from Spectrum called Xumo, X-U-M-O. His Spectrum provided Wi-Fi, and his Wi-Fi extender he bought wasn't able to support all four TVs. I told him about my Ubiquiti Unified networking products I've been using since 2017. He trusts my opinion on computer networking stuff. He bought the same 8-port PoE switch I use. And he bought a U6 Plus access point. I still have the Wi-Fi 5 suits my needs. I think my Pixel is the only thing that uses Wi-Fi 6. And that is Unify's offering for the Wi-Fi 6 line of products. One of the features that sold him was the PoE, which is the power over Ethernet, and the web-based GUI that they use. Overall, he's pretty happy with it. I adjusted the power of the U6 Plus so it doesn't interfere with the Spectrum-provided Wi-Fi 6 access point. One is on the top floor and the other is on the bottom floor. All four TVs stream without an issue, in addition to the several laptops, phones, and tablets that they all have. Believe it or not, that wasn't even everything that I was up to, but I think I've rambled on for long enough, so if I remember any of this in a month's time, I will mention it next episode. So let's see what Eric's been doing.
You know, I always struggle to fill out this section of the notes because the past several months, I just haven't been doing much computer related. And it's funny because anyone else I'm on a podcast with tends to have, you know, volumes of things they're doing. And it definitely makes me feel like I should be stepping things up. Because it's not like I don't have things to do. I have things I'd like to fix, but I just never seem to get around to them anymore. But
you need to be an overachiever.
Oh, I used to be. And now I'm like an overslacker. So keeping that in mind, I start off with, I haven't done very much this month due to having surgery on March 4th, which has kept me laid up and away from my desk almost completely since then. And as proof of that, I opened my laptop today for the first time in probably 4.5-5 weeks, and it had been sleeping this entire time and kind of freaked out a little because it didn't know what to do after having been asleep for, you know, it has to go out and see what the current date is and time, and then it's checking for updates and all this stuff in the background, and it kind of didn't like that. So I rebooted and did a ton of updates, and that took a long time. So anyway, we're back to normal now and ready to get moving, hopefully. So probably the most technical thing I had to deal with was an issue with my Wi-Fi network several weeks ago. And it was pretty frustrating because I couldn't exactly figure out what was going on. I have a bit of a convoluted setup because I have a fiber connection that the endpoint is in my garage. And then it uses a MoCA connection over coaxial cable to a router that's in my office on literally the exact opposite side of the house. So it's a pretty fair distance. That router is owned by my ISP, which is Frontier. And while I do have access to the control panel and can make configuration changes to that router, it's a little locked down and it's a little sort of bare bones. And it also is just in that one location. And again, it's on one side of the house. So if you're on the other side, there's no Wi-Fi signal. So I have a Synology mesh Wi-Fi setup where the main router is next to the ISP's router in the office. And then I have three other access points spread throughout the house. They use a single SSID to provide 2.5 and 5 gigahertz, depending on the device and the strength of the connection and where you are and all of that. I have opted to leave the ISP's access point enabled, which allows me to connect to it to troubleshoot issues maybe with the mesh network. Because I'll be honest with you, Synology has, I've used their NAS system, the disk station, for the better part of a decade, and it's never failed. It's been a great system. Their networking equipment has some really interesting capabilities, especially around monitoring what your kid's doing and providing filtering and stuff like that. So that was really what made me interested in it, because there really aren't great tools available to parents to sort of limit and filter. It's gotten better, but this just seemed like it was turnkey. And so that was really my motivation. But that said, the hardware itself is pretty slow at times and requires a lot of maintenance. Like, it's definitely not something you can just set and forget. That generally means that when I have a problem with the network, that it's going to be the Synology setup, whatever facet or aspect of that it is. And the problem that I was seeing, well, there's one other thing. So I also have a Pi hole running on a Raspberry Pi 2 providing filtering. So that's sort of the full setup of the network. I've got some switches and hubs and stuff like that going too, but
nothing that would be causing a problem like what we were seeing, which was you could connect to the Wi-Fi, the Synology mesh Wi-Fi, but you couldn't get access to anything. And I've seen that behavior before if there was a problem with the ISP where, you know, it'll allow you to connect to the LAN, but then obviously there's no internet access. And that's kind of what we were seeing. And my wife noticed it on her devices, but I wasn't noticing it on the tablet I was using, but then I did notice it on another device and I had her go and reboot everything and that didn't fix it. And then I started looking at configuration stuff and it wasn't that. And it ended up being, at the end of it, the Pi-hole server, because everything was using Pi-hole's DNS and the DNS, for whatever reason, wasn't resolving anything. And therefore, nothing could connect to any domains or anything on the wider internet unless you were using the IP address. I still haven't fixed the Pi-hole server. I just basically switched DNS providers for now because, frankly, I didn't have the physical ability to go and dig it out of the closet to see if there was some physical issue with it. I can't connect to it via SSH, so there's obviously something going on. And I'll dig into it to figure it out because I do like having the filtering from Pi-hole, but I at least figured out it was causing the problem and eliminated it for now. But that's really all I've dealt with this month. So we're going to go ahead and move on to updates.
Updates, where we discuss what we learned about distros we've already reviewed. Void Linux, my favorite rolling distro that is reliable as an added bonus, updated their ISO. They also have Raspberry Pi 5 support. Raspberry Pi images can now be installed on non-SD storage without manual configuration on models that support booting from USB or NVMe. They also now default to a /boot partition of 256 megabytes instead of 64 megabytes, and a link is available in the show notes. Zero Linux is no longer being supported as a distro, and the ISOs have been removed from the website. Actually, the website was completely redesigned. Instead, Dark Zero is going to have a script with options to configure a vanilla Arch installation. He has instructions on how to continue using the current installation if you are using it. And I have a link to the YouTube announcement so you can actually hear it from him and he goes into much more detail. And there's also a forum post on his site that explains it also, what he's planning. Lubuntu and Ubuntu Budgie have updated to Ubuntu 22.04.4, which will continue to be supported until April of 2025. Updates that are specific to Lubuntu are LXQT 0.17.0, QT 5.15.3, Discover Software Center 5.24.7. They mentioned Wayland support is planned for 24.10 with updates to QT 6. And updates specific to Budgie are the Budgie Welcome Translations. There are new applets called Budgie-Media-Applet and Budgie-Carbon-Tray-Applet. A new Colloid-based GTK and icon theme, along with an easy way to install the Mozilla repo version of Firefox. And links to each are in the show notes. And how about you, Eric?
I mostly use Linux Mint these days, so I just went and took a look at their blog post for this for February and wanted to call attention to the fact that they have used HexChat for their IRC client for ever, maybe, but it's being discontinued. And so the post is talking about using either modern alternatives like Discord over IRC, but then also they decided to create their own IRC client named Jargonaut. I'm not exactly sure when that's going to be released, but they're actively working on it. And I think it's out on GitHub with the rest of their repository if someone's interested in either taking a look or contributing to it. That's all I got.
Beautiful failures. What we tried and failed to install or run this month. I was going to review Zebian, and that's X E VIAN, which is a Debian SID distro using XFCE. And SID is the top-level development branch of Debian that is a usable distro, with testing being the next level down. There is an experimental, but it's only a repo, which is above SID. The Zebian maintainers wanted to make a competitor to Zubuntu, which uses the Ubuntu base. The live session looked good. I noticed the installation option was only available during the grub boot selection. It uses the Debian installer. The first attempt failed because it didn't mention requiring an internet connection. I noticed the installer was modified in a few places. It was during the user creation step. There wasn't an option to enable root. The regular user was automatically given sudo access. The other modification was during the grub installation. The second attempt failed because it didn't like using the EFI partition that Windows 11 created. This is the SSD I used on my Lenovo ThinkCentre Tiny to update the Super I/O controller and my Focusrite Solo audio interface. Both of them required Windows, and I just installed 11 just so I could take a look at it. So I rebooted and used Gepartid to remove the partitions. During the third attempt, Zebian failed to install grub. This is part of the installation that is done in the terminal window that opens automatically. I rebooted a fourth time, and it failed again installing grub. At that point, I gave up. I don't know why they modified the installation process. They have their reasons for not using an unmodified Debian installer. I'm still interested in trying it. I will look again this week to see if the problems persist. And well, let's fast forward to this past week I've been home. I downloaded the ISO again and noticed that they have an icon on the desktop of the live ISO, so you can install it from there. They are now using Calamaris. I had high hopes that this was going to be a successful install. Unfortunately, it did not. There was still no mention of needing to connect to the internet, so I had to have a second attempt at installing it. It had errors at the same point. It was running a script called bootloader-config. That entailed installing grub-efi. Then it needed apt to install some dependencies. Apt reported that it could not find the http://deb.debian.org repository. 404, not found, and showing the IP address. That is the main worldwide accessible Debian repo, just so you're aware of the gravity of the situation here. I opened a terminal window and pinged the address, or the domain name, and it resolved to the same IP address that it showed as 404, not found. It didn't have any packet loss on my end. So I thought, I typed sudo apt update. Updated the packet cache, no errors. So I thought, okay, going to sudo apt upgrade, you know, in the live ISO. After a few minutes and answering some question posed by app, because there's some configuration files that it wanted to overwrite and wanted to ask me what to do with them. And the live ISO was updated. So I don't know why their script couldn't do the same thing using the same internet connection. And well, here's a suggestion for other distro maintainers. When you are using a tried, tested, and reliable installation framework, don't fix what is not broken. So we'll see what Eric has been up to here.
So I've been running Fedora 39 Workstation on my Dell Latitude tablet until I wiped it to try KDE Neon, which I cover in this review, or in this episode, I should say. That was probably just about 5 months. I don't have any issues with compatibility per se, although there's a bit more setup required than something like Linux Mint, as you've heard me mention. I prefer distros where I don't have to do a lot of extra legwork, and Fedora is still, it's gotten much better. But you still have to, if you want proprietary codecs and other things, you still have to rely on other distro or on other repositories. And so there's a certain amount of setup that's required. Not trivial, I would say. as much as I loved it when I started using desktop Linux, you know, just to touch on that for a second, I really was in that headspace where I was learning about Linux, and I really, anytime that something broke was an opportunity for me to learn more and fix something. But, you know, I've been using it for over 20 years at this point, and I just want something that's more turnkey. So not that I can't or won't fix problems, especially if it's something that I've invested time in and I'm interested in using, but when I'm seeing a problem with performance, or I'm just having issues right off the bat with a distro where I have to do a bunch of extra work, then usually I'll just stop at that point and use something else. Anyway, I had it configured just fine over those 5 months. And at first it ran fine. You know, I thought it was actually surprising because it was one of the first distros I tried on this PC, this laptop PC, which is over 5 years old, and it's, you know, a very small form factor, so it's not like the best thermals and all that stuff, but it ran really, really well. But what I noticed is that over the time that I was using it, it started to get slow, and not just slow, but very slow. Simple tasks were taking much longer than usual, things like browsing the internet, installing software, moving files, you know, just all the common things that you do on a regular basis were just real, just laggy, slow. The UI was slow to react, and I checked to see if there was something draining resources, and the battery usage was worse. Everything made it seem as though there was something drawing extra power either off the CPU or whatever, but there really wasn't anything. There's nothing running in the background. The fans weren't running, so it's not like the system was being taxed or anything like that. It wasn't warm, so it just was not running well fundamentally. I did as much as I was willing to do. And I also knew that I was coming up to this review for KDE Neon. But the thing I can report here is that KDE Neon runs much better with, and maybe it's Plasma that's running better versus GNOME, I don't know. And maybe it's also something around that it's going to run well at first and then slow down like Fedora did, I'm not sure. So that was sort of my failure, if you want to call it that. It's not like there was a fault that, you know, the system was crashing, but it literally got to a point where it was unusable, you know, to just do basic things. So I found myself not really using it, honestly. And I stopped taking it with me, which, you know, that was the whole point, was to have it with me because it was a tablet and a computer. But it seems like Neon, well, maybe not Neon, but Plasma might be the better choice. And I'll get to that pretty much right now. So let's move on to the reviews. So this month I reviewed KDE Neon, the user edition, and the ISO is neon-user-2024-0321-0715.iso, which was the most recent release. KDE Plasma 6 was recently released, and I was curious to try it. So I thought I would work it into this review, and that was my main criteria for picking a candidate. And so KDE Plasma 6 was just released. So of course, you're going to see it in rolling releases because they're the ones that can get any kind of like a new software base or package into their repositories quickly and then disseminate it to their users. And anything that's a fixed release is probably going to take longer to work it in because they have to, you know, they're doing point releases versus a rolling release. So, you know, that kind of gave me something like Arch or OpenSUSE, which I really didn't want to use. Fedora 40 is going to have it in their KDE spin, but that hasn't been released yet, and I don't want to review something that's pre-release. So all of this sort of made me think of KDE Neon as being the most logical and straightforward choice because their user edition is considered their stable version, and Plasma 6 had been released to that stable version. So that's what I went with. Also, interestingly, it was the only one in the bunch that automatically scaled the display to a reasonable resolution, in my case, 150%. That might be a little large for younger eyes, but certainly was appreciated by my less than young eyes at this point. The full resolution of the screen is 1920 by 1280 on a 12.3-inch screen. When I was younger, sure, that would have been fine. I wouldn't have had to get close to it. But as it is, if 100% scaling, that's a little too small at this point. So yeah, that was nice to have it not be so tiny that it's so small that even to just get to the control panel to change the resolution is tricky, you know, to be able to see it. That may be hard for younger people to believe, but just you wait.
Yes, I had my eye exam this week and my prescription changed, and so I feel you.
Yeah, and it keeps changing too. Hopefully it doesn't keep doing that forever, but anyway. I've also been using Linux Mint, as I mentioned, for my main distro for quite a while now, so my comparisons are to that base, right, which is still an Ubuntu base, and then also the Cinnamon desktop. The main difference is a newer kernel, some things like that, but obviously the desktops. My hardware, as I mentioned, it's a Dell Latitude 5290 2-in-1 tablet PC. It has an 8th generation Intel Core i5, the 8350U processor, which is 15-watt TDP, quad core. I have 16 gigs of 2133 megahertz RAM. I have an M.2 512 gigabyte PCIe NVMe. A lot of acronyms. 12.3-inch touch WUXGA Plus, so it's 1920 by 1280, as I said. It's a very capable little system, which is why, like I mentioned previously, Fedora was kind of bumming me out, because it's really a pretty zippy for being what it is. So installation ease and issues. The installer is very straightforward. It's just Calamari's, and it's, you know, it is Calamari's. I mean, there's really not much else to say if you know it. I chose the replace option when I got to the partitioning section, and I just selected the Fedora 39 partition, and it essentially just replaces it and then uses all of the same settings, so the same EFI partition and all of that. It also picked up the Windows installation, because I also have Windows on that tablet because it came with it, and it's always a fallback if I'm having some kind of weird issue, I guess. So yeah, the installer, it's really straightforward and pretty easy to use. Post-installation hardware facts and issues. After installing and rebooting, I was greeted with an eye-watering 100% screen brightness level for no good reason, because it wasn't like that when I installed. So I turned it down, and I keep it at like 25-30% on that system because it's a pretty bright screen. So after adjusting it down, it hasn't done that since. So I don't know, you know, why it was like that. On a more positive note, it remembered the Wi-Fi password, which I, from the live install session, a lot of them don't. And it's not like it's the biggest thing in the world to have to re-enter the password, but when you have systems that do it, then you know it's possible. And it's just like, for the ones that don't do it, you know, just take the extra time to implement that, you know. It's a little thing, but anyway, I like little things that make my life easier. The new wallpaper is pretty nice. I like the design of it. KDE tends to have very like geometric type wallpapers, usually patterns and things like that. And so I kind of like that this is a more organic style. And I also like that they have a light and a dark variant. So depending on which version of the desktop you have it set to, or if you have the timed feature where it goes to dark mode in the evening, it's consistent across that, which is nice. Outside of the wallpaper, there's a new floating option for the bottom panel that's enabled by default. So it's sort of, instead of being full width by default, it's sort of just floating a little bit above the bottom of the screen by, I don't know, 10 pixels or 15 pixels or something like that. And, you know, sure, it's a nice little touch. It's something different. The coolest part is probably that when you get a window near it, it'll sink back down and then go to full width and kind of get out of the way. That's kind of neat. I did notice, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it seems relevant here, the on-screen keyboard, the virtual keyboard, when I was using it like a tablet, the panel did not respond to that opening and stayed floating and actually covered over the bottom of the keyboard just a little bit, not enough that it was unusable, but I could see how the panel needs to account for things like that, and it just doesn't yet at this point. I'm sure they've gotten that feedback from someone at this point, so I would assume that would be fixed eventually. So outside of the floating panel, there's really not much. I mean, if you booted into a 5 series and a 6 series side by side, I'm pretty sure the floating panel might be the only thing that you would notice. The menu's the same, the panel's the same, the layout, the icons, the, you know, the desktop wallpaper, as I mentioned, is different, but you know, that doesn't really, it's not a functional thing. So And I think that because it was a full version release, you know, 5 to 6, that there would have been some kind of like a visual, like, hey, here's version 6, like, da-da-da, you know, and they're just, I booted in and was just like, oh, is this really 6? Like, that was a bit of a, I don't want to say a letdown, but it was definitely less dramatic than I had kind of thought. Because, I mean, most desktop environments, when you go between a 2 and a 3 or a 5 and a 6, like, it's usually pretty dramatic. Like, there's a very visible difference between the two. So,
yeah, because I've heard from others that saying that there some people are comparing the Qt 6 to pretty much the rationale that Linus uses for going to the next major kernel version is because he can't count more than 21 because he only has 10 fingers and 10 toes.
Yeah. And I get that the Qt 6 upgrade, you know, the transition was not trivial. It's a lot of work. And it's a good thing, obviously, that they transitioned, and it's hopefully going to open the way for them to make different innovations and changes and have like real impacts on the future of Plasma. But deciding to make it a 6 release, you know, a full release, and not having any kind of a flourish or a, it was a little bit of a wah wah instead of a da da da, if that makes any sense. So. But I did notice pretty quickly that the performance seemed to be much better, as I mentioned in the Beautiful Failures, on this base as well as KDE Plasma. So I can't be 100% sure, you know, what it is that's causing that. I would guess probably Plasma over GNOME, maybe more than the base. But obviously, this is an Ubuntu base versus a Fedora base, and there's a lot of differences there as well. So I'm not entirely sure, but all I know is that for right now, at least. After having been installed for little less than a month, that it seems to be much quicker. And over that time, there's been a ton of updates as well. So it's not like it's, you know, static in place. There's been a lot of big updates and things like that. I've installed things. And so it seems to be running pretty well at this point, which is great. And that's the type of device where you're going to notice something that's not running well. That's for sure. There are definitely some rough edges, you know, not unexpected with a, you know, a major release. Not all of them are easily attributable specifically to Neon or Plasma itself. The usual set of home folders wasn't created, which I thought was a really strange thing, and I'm not sure I've ever seen that before, where you open Dolphin, in this case the file manager, and you're automatically at the home folder, and the only thing in there is desktop. None of the other folders that are supposed to be there were there. I was like, okay. And the way I noticed it was actually when I was trying to download something in Firefox, I kept clicking the download link and nothing was happening. You know, the download menu wasn't opening, and I'm like, okay, so maybe Firefox is freaking out a little bit. Closed it, opened it back up, same behavior. And then I went to the file manager and I'm like, well, where's downloads? That doesn't make any sense. So I had to manually create those. The other interesting thing was I went into the control panel and there's a section in there called locations, and it does show all of the correct directories and their associated paths. So something, I guess, in the install process or where that would happen. Just, I know usually too, there's a skel directory in etc, which has sort of a skeleton of the home directory. So when you create a new home, a new user, their home inherits that sort of set of directories by default. And so that's not there. Maybe that's what caused it. I'm not entirely sure. I went and did some searching and couldn't find anything obvious. And I think a new user would probably be very confused by that. Newer user maybe that would have expected them to be there. I know I certainly did. And maybe just that would flummox them to a point where they wouldn't know what to do. But anyway, very odd thing, like I said, that I don't think I've encountered before. I had some other things like Firefox shortcut in the panel. Every time I rebooted, it would be removed. No idea why, because it was just same way I added everything else, and everything else stayed. I'd, you know, right-click, add shortcut to panel, and it was just like, why does this keep getting reset? So no idea. You know, it's just a silly thing, man. I'm sure, again, I'm expecting to see these types of small things in a major release, because they changed a lot of stuff. Not visually apparent, not something that I can see a difference in, but I'm sure under the, you know, in the coat itself, there's been a lot of changes. So the other thing was the, if you're on Plasma, when you open Firefox, it'll prompt you in the tray. There's a little icon that said it's asking you to install the Plasma add-on for Firefox, which allows it to do some better integration between the two. Even though it was installed, every time I'd open Firefox, it would prompt again. So just, you know, little goofy stuff like that. None of the stuff that I encountered caused any crashes or I didn't lose any data or anything like that. But it was definitely just weird, goofy things that you wouldn't, you know, normally expect. So they rearranged a bunch of stuff in the control panel, which I appreciate because it's an attempt to simplify and streamline the myriad options that appear there. But I will say that it's a bit annoying to someone who knows where things are supposed to based on, you know, previous versions, and then they're just not there. Or they're under a completely different menu. Or, for example, as I mentioned, looking up the locations to see where the folder paths were and stuff like that, that's now under an option all the way at the bottom of the menu tree that's session. And I would have never guessed it was there. But anyway, I was able to search on the top. So thankfully, there's a search in the control panel and it points you to where the thing is. But yeah, it's a little, not off-putting, but just a little confusing because it's you go to where you think something is and it's like, oh, that's not there anymore. I'm sure it won't take too long to kind of adjust to it, but it's definitely a change. And hopefully it is for the better. You know, hopefully it's more logical to new users. I don't know. I've gotten so used to it being the way it was that I don't know one way or the other if it's actually true. So as usual with my other Dell PCs, I had to enable the deep sleep option in the grub configuration file. Prior to doing that, the system was still running when I closed the keyboard cover, which there was really no way to know until I picked it up the next time, 12 hours later, or the next day, and it was dead. Sleep still isn't working perfectly. If it sleeps long enough, it seems like it shuts down and doesn't recover like when you start it up. So I don't know, something I'll have to play with, I guess. But at least the battery's not dead when you go back to it. KDE Neon comes pre-configured with Flatpak and Snap. So you combine that with the underlying distro repository and you have access to a pretty substantial amount of software. Unfortunately, Discover, it's still not a particularly great software manager, which at this point to me just seems kind of impossible. It's been like a decade, or at least close to it, that we've been using Discover, and it just still is buggy and weird. The UI, the layout, like all of it is just strange to me. Maybe it's because I'm used to using the GTK package managers and software centers and stuff. And honestly, I use the command line more than graphical, but I use the graphical to browse. Because browsing on the command line is kind of like, what do you do? Just you're guessing versus you're seeing it in front of you with a software center. So I usually use it to browse and look at new packages or different packages. Or no offense to the people who work on it. I'm sure they put in a lot of effort, but it just still is a problem for me. It's a bit of a shame that Discovery hasn't improved much because KDE Neon comes pretty much devoid of software beyond the very, very minimal basics. Like there's no Office Suite or audio player, things like that. I have to think most people, whenever they install an operating system, they kind of expect each sort of basic area of functionality or something that they would be doing on the system has at least a minimal app to cover it. I guess a lot of people like not having bloat, maybe, if that's what some people call the extra software. But I kind of like when a distro picks software that is well integrated and all like works well together and has been tested. And that kind of gives me like a starting point. Yeah, maybe I don't like this app and I can change it out, but at least I know I've got sort of a full set of applications. Yes, it makes the ISO bigger and there's all sorts of trade-offs, but to me, that's a better experience than what I encountered in Neon. But it's not unusable. I mean, it's fine. You know, I just noticed because I went to do something and there was no supported app for it. And I thought, oh, that's odd. Because I was using a tablet PC, I was able to test touchscreen support. And I removed the magnetic keyboard cover and was able to rotate the vise, which is tricky for some distros and desktop environments, that rotation doesn't always work properly. Sometimes it like goes upside down or weird things like that. But in this case, it worked fine. I was not presented with a virtual keyboard, which I thought was interesting when I tapped a text entry. And although that's not entirely unheard of, sometimes it doesn't automatically pop up. You know, sometimes you have to toggle it manually, but there was no toggle or anything. So I went into the keyboard settings and the control panel, and I saw that the, I'm going to say Malit, it's M-A-L-I-I-T, keyboard was available, but it was disabled. No idea why. So I enabled it, and then I was able to tap a text entry field, and it popped up as expected. In every case except, what was it, Discord. For whatever reason, Discord, and maybe because it's a Electron app, I don't know. I don't know why it is, but I could see sometimes, and I've had that issue before on other desktops. GNOME does that too. Certain apps, for whatever reason, just don't trigger. I mean, it doesn't call, make a call to the virtual keyboard or however that works. Everything else was fine, even Telegram. So it wasn't just, you know, third party versus core apps or system apps. So Discord was the one that was the outlier, although I'm sure there are others that I just didn't encounter. But I was able to manually toggle it because there was an icon in the tray. So that let me, you know, and I could still type and all that. So it was fine. There was a workaround for it. There was no real settings for the keyboard. So, I mean, none that I could find, at least. So there was no way for me to make any changes to the height of it or maybe use it as a floating keyboard or any of that kind of stuff. So it was pretty basic keyboard. There were autocomplete suggestions along the top, but not consistently. There were some apps where those were not shown. Like anything on the, like I went to the control panel and tapped the search field there and started typing and nothing was being suggested. So, but I went back to, I was doing the show notes and it's a browser-based text editor. When I tapped that and started typing, I was given suggestions. So, not sure what that was about. It also worked fine when I rotated. So I would still have the keyboard and it would rotate back and forth. So that was good. It's a minimal viable, you know, offering, but it actually worked well enough. I just don't understand why it wasn't enabled by default. So maybe there just aren't enough people using it. The manual toggle in the tray, I guess this is the last thing on that. It was a little clunky. And then I also noticed, as I mentioned before, the floating panel wasn't reacting to it opening. And so it was in a way a bit. It did support touch. It supported rotation, the virtual keyboard and all that. And it was fine, but it's not refined enough that it would be usable every day. I think you'd kind of get a little frustrated, perhaps, with how it was working. Because it really did take up a lot of the screen as well. Even in portrait mode, it was a good third of the screen. So maybe a bit too big. And again, no way that I could see to change it. There is a Plasma Mobile project, so maybe there's some sort of crossover there or something you could use, or maybe that's just the better solution for a tablet. I don't know. But because KDE Plasma performs so well on this device, I may spend some time trying to get it to work a little better, but probably not on the Neon base, which I'll get to. Ease of use. Besides the lack of software and home folders, there wasn't anything that hindered using the system as expected. Hardware support was fine, and it has the newer 6.5 kernel. So, you know, I think people with newer hardware would be fine with Neon. The system I'm using is pretty simple and old enough that everything just works. So it really wasn't an issue for me. Memory and disk use. I used the WildTrue do free HM sleep 10 command after booting. And it just sat at 1.4 gigabytes. Like it never went up or down. And yeah, that's not lightweight. And I know Plasma is capable of doing way better than that. So I'm not sure what the deal was. But yeah, 1.4, not so great.
I don't think in all the distros we've reviewed in the past 4 years or however long this has been going on, maybe coming up on five, I don't think I've ever heard one. I think there were a few times where I think some GNOME ones were 1.1, 1.2. I think Cinnamon at one point, I think, was teetering on like 1.1, 1.2. But that is high.
Yeah. And especially considering there's almost no ancillary software at all. There's, you know, so, you know, in terms of things starting up and using memory, and there's almost nothing there. So yeah, it was surprising. And I agree with you. I had one, I think was a GNOME install on something that was like a 1.2, which isn't unusual because GNOME's going to be right around one and maybe a tiny bit over. But yeah, 1.4 was, and also, so the disk space used was 11 gigs, which again, where is that space? Because I would expect that with a distro that's giving me a bunch of other stuff. And yeah, it's a little surprising. But again, I think if you're looking at the purpose, so initially when Neon was started, it wasn't even suggested for users to run it as a distro. Like they weren't even calling it a distro necessarily. It was a test bed. It was a, you know, proof of concept, kind of like how GNOME's one is. You can get GNOME from them. It'll run as a distro, but it's not a distro. It's not supported as a distro. But Neon since then, because they have the user edition, I think is very much more in the, this is a distro. And it's the main purpose of it, though, is getting you the latest version of Plasma.
Yeah. That's when I started. I think they started that in, I could be wrong, but I'm thinking they started that at 2017, 2018, where it's like the user distro. But I'm wondering if some of this isn't like debug code that they've got running.
Could be.
Sending some analytics back to them. Because I remember, I think it was 2018, they actually got rid of all their scripts that were used to start up the system and replaced them with actual binaries. And it actually increased or decreased the boot time like 30 seconds because it wasn't having to run all these scripts to start everything. And I remember that was thinking it was 2018. I'm thinking somewhere around there because I remember it was 5.18. And I remember the big excerpt from the changelog was that they converted all of their init scripts to a binary and the binary just executes all of it.
And that would speak to supporting it more like a distro, whereas previously they probably didn't care that it took 30 seconds or whatever to start up. Yeah. So,
and it could be also why you're missing your directories.
My reviews are never meant to be like negatively critical, but they're also honest. So, you know, I'm just kind of saying what I saw. So anyway, so ease of finding help. KDE Neon provides support via the KDE Discourse forum. There's a section in there for it. Telegram and Matrix. So you've got a forum option and two chat options. And I didn't need to reach out to anyone, so I can't say like how responsive or helpful the people on there are. But I have to assume that, you know, you're probably going to be talking to a KDE developer in those instances. Maybe on Matrix, I would guess. Maybe not Telegram or Discourse, but. Anyway, I think you certainly would be able to get help if you needed it, and so that's fine. Plays nice with others. Like I said, the installation found and added the Windows partition into the boot menu. That's usually my criteria for playing nice with others, and it worked fine. It also connected without any extra configuration to my NAS and the network shares and all of that, so that was fine. Stability, I didn't have any crashes or performance issues, so stability was not a problem. Similar distros to check out. So this is a little different because there really aren't many options in terms of distros offering KDE Plasma 6 at this point. But that won't be true for very long. Kubuntu will probably have it available in their backports PPA pretty soon. And I expect any distro that has a point release will have a KDE version that's a point release, non-rolling, I guess. Is going to incorporate Plasma 6 in their near future release. In the meantime, you can get it on Neon, you can get it in the rolling releases like Arch and OpenSUSE. I don't think any major show-stopping issues have been found so far, and that's really the only thing that keeps distros from promoting to newer versions is if there's some like either major retooling that has to happen or an extraordinary amount of effort, basically, to get it included. And I don't think that's the case here, but we'll see. So ratings, ease of installation, new user. You know, just because when I see the word new user, the words new user, I think there's always possibility for them to take a wrong turn. But, you know, it's calamaries. It's pretty straightforward. I mean, so little you could do wrong, besides maybe partitioning, which again, in this case, I think it's pretty straightforward, especially if they're just taking over a whole disk. So I said 8 out of 10, just to be pragmatic. It might be a little higher, but you know, that's what I'm going to stick with. Experienced user, 10 out of 10. I mean, anyone who knows Linux is going to have zero issues with the installation. Hardware support with the newer kernel, I imagine, you know, even newer systems than mine are not going to have issues. So 10 out of 10. And with Ubuntu's hardware compatibility stuff, usually that's even better. So we just talked about finding help, you know, 10 out of 10. Ease of use, I put 8 out of 10 just simply because, you know, I've had some of the little weird issues, the folders being missing. Like there was definitely some things that had to be corrected before it was just ready to jump in and use. And I'm still taking away a point for Discover as well, because Discover for normal people, I think, would be frustrating. So I have an 8 out of 10 on that. Plays nice with others. I talked about it, seeing the Windows partition. So 10 out of 10. And no issues with stability, so 10 out of 10. And that gives me an overall rating of 8 out of 10. Before I get to my final comment, I wanted to mention one other thing. And I can't imagine it doesn't bother other people. And the reason I'm thinking of this is because I just saw a notification pop up, and I'm on Cinnamon right now. If I open the notifications panel on Cinnamon, any one of these notifications, if I click on it, and this goes for GNOME and Budgie and pretty much any other desktop I can think of, it will go to the application that the notification originated from. Sometimes even to the direct message that it was for or whatever it is. And Plasma does not do that. It drives me nuts. Now, they had overhauled the notifications quite a bit to like cut down on the amount there are, or that groups them together. And there have definitely been improvements, but it drives me absolutely crazy whenever I look down and I see I have 3 notifications and I open it up and it shows me what they are and even gives me a verbose message, but clicking on it does absolutely nothing. And it's just like, have you guys seen other desktop environments? So I know it's maybe a stupid gripe, but it's such a oversight in functionality, and notifications are important because that's how you know you missed something that you have to check on. Anyway, sorry to derail, but that just has driven me crazy. And the fact that they have not fixed it, and as far as I know, have no plans to fix it, just because I looked at some tickets logged on it years ago, you know, after they had made the improvements, thinking, oh, well, okay, they made these improvements and that'll be one of the next things they do. Nope, wasn't even on the roadmap. So anyway.
It's not a bug, it's a feature.
Right. So my final comments, this review covered KDE Neon as well as KDE Plasma 6, but my interest was really more in Plasma than Neon. I was hoping that a new version of Plasma might renew my interest, as I used to be pretty much exclusively a KDE Plasma user, especially when the other options were nowhere near as capable or refined from my perspective. Like, I wasn't a fan of most of the other desktops, nor was I much of a tiling window manager user. And Plasma was essentially, you know, the winner by default. But as other desktops evolved and added features and refinements, I found myself wanting to use them more than Plasma for any number of reasons. But the effect of that is I've not really used Plasma much since then in favor of mostly GNOME and Cinnamon. Like I said, I'd really hoped that maybe 6 was going to be something transformative or, you know, special. And not to... I'm trying really hard not to make this sound ungrateful, because I know there was a tremendous amount of effort put into the Qt transition and there were a ton of under the hood bugs fixed and stuff like that. I just don't think that this release had much of the impact that I had hoped it was going to have. Now, maybe 6.1 will be amazing, or 6.5. I don't know. I certainly hope so. And hopefully this was laying the foundation for that effort moving forward, that now everything just is much easier to do, or they didn't want to take on any of the larger areas of functionality because they're waiting for Qt 6. Whatever it is, hopefully this kind of gets them past that and we can see some real interesting things in the future because of the effort that took place here. Another thing is, and maybe this is just because I've been using GTK-based desktop environments for such a long time, Qt-based software just always seems a little less than. For whatever reason, it's just less featureful, less refined, less useful. And I know that's a bit of a blanket statement and is unfair because there are certainly some Qt-based apps like Krita, you know, for drawing and more than that. I mean, that's the one that popped into my head, but there certainly is a wealth of Qt-based software, but it seems like all of the stuff I use on a regular basis is mostly GTK-based. And so when I am looking at Plasma, as much as I love Dolphin, Dolphin is an unbelievable file manager, probably the best that I've ever used on any operating system in terms of features and capabilities. And, you know, if you're an IT person who has to deal with file operations a lot, like, Dolphin's amazing, but it's also Qt and not Qt in that sense, like Qt is in Qt, and it just doesn't look good to me. And I don't know why. And it's such a silly thing, but I'm back on Cinnamon right now to do this recording and it just looks so much better to me for whatever reason. So it's a very personal thing. I've talked to other people and they've said the similar things. And I've talked to people that are the exact opposite, that prefer Qt over GTK. So very personal choice, but Plasma has got to really change more for me to probably want to come back to it. So for now, I think maybe on this tablet, I will keep going with Plasma simply because it runs so well. Although I can't necessarily say it was GNOME's fault. It might've been Fedora itself, but it's on there now. I don't know if I want to stay with Neon simply because of the issues that I've had. And I also want to test another version of Plasma 6 to see if they're similar or the same issues. So I will probably be using Plasma more now than I had been previously, but I don't see myself switching to it over other options just simply because it just feels the same as it did in 5. You know, that's a personal disappointment for me. But that does not at all say that I'm disappointed in the effort that was put in by the, you know, the team members and developers and everyone who's helping at Neon and Plasma, who have obviously put a ton of effort into this. Outside of those very minor issues that I had, there was nothing show-stopping. And I think that speaks volumes to the amount of effort that went into all of the changes that took place. They made it look boring, which is a good thing. So that's really where I'm going to leave it. Hopefully in the future, like I said, we'll see more out of Plasma in terms of transformative changes. Maybe we won't. Maybe that's the point. I'm not sure. But for now, I'm going to be happy on Cinnamon and look for more in the future. All right, Dale, what did you do this month?
Well, like always, I'm trying to decide what I'm going to review next. I always have to go look at the ones that I've already done, make sure it's not something I haven't done recently. And when I was on Telegram looking through the groups that I'm participating in, there is a user, Swift110, and he's in a lot of the same groups than I am. And he's always been a big fan of Bunsen Labs. And I hadn't used it before. I had seen CrunchBang, which I'll get into, back in the day. And this is the spiritual successor, which I'll get into my intro here. But that's pretty much where I got the idea from, is from suggestions from other people or just ones that somebody mentions. And I just take a look at it and see if there's enough there to do a review on. Because some of these ones are sort of very bespoke distros that they, and not like what Eric says, is, you know, disparage or take away the efforts people put into things, but some of the distros are just dog fooding. They wanted to do something for themselves, and it's really not really meant to do anything other than to suit their needs. And if anyone else likes using it, then, you know, so be it. That's basically how Zero Linux started. Dark Zero just had an affinity for a certain way of configuring his distro, and people wanted it. But in any case, what I am reviewing this month is Bunsen Labs Linux, and it's their Boron release. Bunsen Labs is a continuation of CrunchBang Linux. I don't have a firm start date for CrunchBang. The third release was in November of 2008 using Ubuntu 8.10. During the spring of 2010, they began to rebase on Debian 6 Squeeze. The first non-development release, called Statler, was in February of 2011 using the stable version of Debian 6. They used release names from the Muppet Show characters. It was a sketch comedy show using Muppets that looked like animals and weird type of monsters in the mid-1970s, and I think it may have been in reruns until at least the mid-80s. Crunch Bang continued until February of 2015, when it was decided to stop development. Two distros spun off of that release called Crunch Bang Plus Plus, and I've seen it spelled out plus plus, and I've seen it more commonly with two plus signs, and Bunsen Labs. The Crunch Bang website started redirecting to Bunsen Labs once it was created in September of 2015. The first release of Bunsen Labs was in July of 2016 called Hydrogen. And they get the names boron and hydrogen. They're all chemical elements on the elementary table of elements. Instead of using a desktop environment, they are using a modified OpenBox window manager. It uses stacking, or commonly called floating window management. This is what you would normally see in something like Cinnamon or Mate, etc. My hardware, I use my Lenovo ThinkPad T460. It has an Intel dual-core i5-6200U, 2.8 GHz, and a 14-inch display using the integrated 520 graphics, 16 gigabytes of RAM, and I put a new drive in it. It's a 1 terabyte Crucial BX500. It was the one I bought by mistake when I thought it was a MX500. But I just decided to put it to use. Installation ease and issues. The installation is the Debian graphical installer, but it's themed with the Bunsen Lab logo and colors. They automatically make your user have pseudo access, so you don't have to do that step of the regular Debian install process. Other than that, it's a normal Debian installation. Post-installation hardware facts and issues. Grub menu had the default options with the additions of TTY login and a high contrast text. Upon first login, everything was working as expected. There wasn't a graphical way to disable the touchpad. If that annoys you like it does me, in the command line I typed X input to find the ID number for the touchpad, and it was 12. It's usually 12, so I'm not sure if that ever gets enumerated any differently. Then I typed X input set-prop 12 12, double quote, device, space, enabled, in double quote, space, the number 0. This is all in the show notes. Then it was disabled, where 0 is disabled and 1 is enabled. There are settings in the home folder in the .config/bunsen/autostart file, and there's a touchpad section, but I could never get the palm detection settings working. I don't know why, but I'm just going to leave it like that. Could be user error, who knows. So I just disabled the touchpad since I don't use it, and I just haven't used it since Alps invented them. I don't know what it is, but I can tolerate it a little bit on my Pangolin since it only has a touchpad if I don't want to go to the bag and get the trackball out. But yeah, there's a limit to how much I can tolerate that. And I'm thinking, because that's a 15.6-inch laptop, I'm thinking the keyboard is spaced out enough where I'm not touching the touchpad, but it still annoys me. And there's a button where I just hit function or whatever the function key is, FN, and I can turn my touchpad off with hardware. If you do want to go that route, that is only good for that session. When you reboot, it gets re-enabled. So you will need to put that command in that auto start file that I mentioned. If you want to adjust other settings for the mouse, the acceleration and other, you know, settings like that, you can install xfce4-settings by way of sudo apt install XFCE 4-Settings. After it is installed, it can be found under All Application Settings and Setting Manager, and it also puts a mouse and touchpad menu option there as well. Linux kernel 6.1.0-18 is being used. I noticed that the swap file was created equal to the amount of memory installed. So if you want to do any type of hibernation and stuff like that, it'll work. In the system settings menu, there is an item called Install Favorite Packages. It is a pipe menu that expands to other entries. Those entries allow you to install other applications easily, like web browsers, terminal emulators, utilities, in addition to many others. Flatpak and Snaps are not configured, nor are they installed. Here are a few of the pre-installed apps. And again, they're taking from XFCE here and using the Thunar file manager. Or I should say I'm taking from it because I had to install their mouse settings. Catfish file search, Nitrogen for setting the wallpaper, Quick Screenshot, Genie, which is an IDE. I think it's, what is that? Something development library. I don't know what the I is. Internal or independent development dependent environment. I don't know. Rosetto, Image Viewer, VLC, Video Player, the Swiss knife of playing videos, HexChat, IRC client, Firefox ESR 115.8, and LibreOffice, Calc, and Writer 7.4. And then you got a few terminals to pick from. You got the LX terminal from the LXDE project, XFC terminal from XFCE, and the X terminal emulator, which I think is some independent one. There is a Conky on the upper right-hand corner of the screen. It shows RAM and CPU usage along with the keyboard shortcuts. Some common ones are Super T for the terminal, Super F for the file manager, Super L for the lock screen, and the print screen button for screenshots. And there's many others. The T2 panel is vertical on the left side with the system tray at the bottom. By default, there are two virtual desktops, and some people refer to them, like me, as workspaces, and more can be added and removed. Menu access is available from the super key or right-clicking the mouse. The menu appears floating wherever you happen to right-click the mouse. It has docked items at the top of the menu for a terminal, web browser, file manager, text editor, and media player. The remaining is menus for application utilities and to lock the screen and exit the desktop session. You're able to adjust the screen resolution, manage the Conky, change the default applications, open box configuration, in addition to many of the other common ones. I go into more detail about these settings and utilities when I review distros using window managers, mostly because a fair percentage of people are not familiar with them or have preconceived notions that everything needs to be done in the terminal. That is true in some cases, though there are some nice GUI options that can be installed or are installed by default. For those of you like wallpaper selection, the default is a blue-green background with some geometric shapes and the Bunsen Labs logo at the bottom. There are quite a few others with dark textures and the Bunsen Lab logo. They're pretty cool looking. And there are some light ones, but not as many. I think there was only a couple light scenery type ones. Ease of use. As I have mentioned in previous reviews, I was a fan of OpenBox in the early 2000s, mid-2000s. I'm surprised how much interest there is still for it. The functionality has changed since then, but for the better. I like the ability of pressing the super key to open the menus in Bunsen Labs. I don't think that was even a thing until, I don't know, I think Windows 95 may have had it, but I don't think it caught on into the Linux world until, I think, Unity came out, I think. But I digress. This is my favorite part of my current workflow. I just find searching through menus a bit tedious anymore. However, I do find them helpful when I can't remember what I'm searching for. This is one of the functionality changes that I mentioned, which is the use of metadata, where you type in editor and it will show you all the applications that are editors. Of course, that is dependent on the person putting in the right meta tags for it. One of the differences using OpenBox compared to a desktop environment is the workspace's separation of applications. When I used Alt-Tab to cycle through the open applications, it would only show the ones on that workspace. In order to Alt-Tab the others, I needed to move to that workspace. Though I am able to see the icons on the vertical panel on the left that I mentioned, clicking on the workspaces will also display it. So there are mouse and keyboard options for your preferred way of interacting. When I clicked on the icon of the application, it would switch to that workspace and show the application. Clicking on it again would minimize it from the view. Clicking it again will restore it. To have an overview list of workspaces and applications, I pressed the Super Tab key. From there, I could use the up and down arrows to select an application from all the workspaces. Additionally, I could add or remove workspaces, though they are labeled as desktops, so that's interchangeable. Sometimes I've seen it referred to as virtual desktops. Some of these functions are available as settings in some of the common desktop environments, so you may have seen these before. As per usual, I used app in the terminal for my package management. There is the Synaptic Package Manager installed, and it is a very nice GUI application. Because honestly, I forget about it. I'm just so used to going into the terminal, because I can just do sudo apt update and sudo apt upgrade and just hit enter and walk away. Synaptic, though, does not have any plugin ability to support installing Flatpaks or Snaps. I enabled Flatpak using the Debian instructions from flatpak.org because I can never remember. Despite how many times I've typed in over the years, I still can't remember the whole line. When I installed Telegram, I went into the advanced options and enabled Use System Window Frame. Doing that allows it to match the theme of the other applications. I also enable Show Taskbar Icon and disable the Tray Icon. The Tray Icon functionality in OpenBox is a bit limited. The only options were Open and Exit. It seemed redundant to me since I could do that without it being there. The only side effect of using that option is when you exit, it exits. It doesn't minimize to the tray. What I always do on every computer I use, I just open it on a workspace and leave it open, and I just go to that workspace when I want to use it, when I get a notification. The lock screen and the Light DM display manager were themed very nicely, which is a nice touch that some distros don't do. I guess they just figured they'd let the user do that. And in fairness, some of these are the more advanced distros, like Void. When you have XFCE, nothing's configured. It looks like it's from the 1990s. So you have to theme everything. Oh, it's maybe not that bad. The login screen is, yeah, but the default look to it is kind of dated, but some people like that. Other than the right-click menu to find uncommonly used applications, I got along very well with Bunsen Labs. Memory disk use, it was about 6.6 gigabytes on the SSD. That was using the du-h/, which starts in the root folder and tells you what's there. And the memory usage floored me. I mean, I'm still in disbelief. It was 824 megabytes to 840 megabytes reported by free-hm, and that's using the 30-second intervals. And I let it run for about 4 or 5 minutes. That's like 300 more than what it should be. And I didn't really go, and I'm not that pedantic that I went into and typed PSA UX in the terminal and actually looked at every single running process and, you know, added it up. So I'm not sure exactly, you know, what's running, but I'm sure that Conky is probably using 100, 200 megabytes maybe, but that's not three, you know, or four. But well, the ease of finding help. I did search their forum to see what others did for disabling the touchpad. I also browsed around to see their other posts. The forum seemed fairly active, with a few posts being that day and a few days in the past. And that's where I got some of those commands that I used above. It refreshed my memory because I remember X input, but every time I want to do anything with it, I always have to look at the man page to remember what the commands are. So it was just nice to find them in there. The play's nice with others. Well, I slacked off on this. I didn't dual boot it with anything, mostly because it's Debian and it's using Ext4 file system. I mean, Ext4 has been around for, what, a decade at least? So if you're using something similar to Debian or Ubuntu, then you shouldn't have a problem. It's only when you use less common file systems or non-standard grub configurations or system dboot. I mean, Windows is even, you know, more friendly with Linux these days. Stability, I didn't have any issues with that. It's basically Debian with a window manager that dates back 24 years, though it has been updated by the Bunsen devs, but I mean, you can't get any more tried and true than that. I mean, the code's been through so many eyeballs, it's good to go. And then trying to gaming with it. Similar distros to check out. And like I said, there's Crunchbang++, which is another Debian base. Sparky Linux, OpenBox Edition, is another Debian base. And Archcraft, which is a Arch base. I reviewed it in episode 43. And it was one of my more positive Arch experiences, except for their package manager, which I'm not going to get into my dismay of Pac-Man, or even Pamac for that matter, for Manjaro. My ratings, for the ease of installation, new user, I'm still just on the fence of 6 and 7 because the Debian installer is really not that intuitive. If you go with a lot of the auto features in there, you should be okay. But your mileage may vary on that. I just don't know why Calamaris isn't more used, but I digress. Experience user, that's a hit out of the park. It's going to be a 10. Hardware issues, well, it's 10. Ease of finding help, the community and web, it's 10 out of 10. It's a nice form. Ease of use. And I really rated this higher. I was on the fence with this one too. I said 9, but only because it's more of the point and clicky nature of it. People are more inclined to that. As long as they know where to click on the thing, they can get along with it. I don't know really how many people would use the workspaces. I'm thinking that might even add to some confusion in some instances where they click on it and they didn't mean to. And then they end up with like two Firefoxes running, which could be an issue. So I'd say for functionality use, it's 9. And Eric had talked about these rating systems in the before we recorded. So there might be some updates on this in the future. Plays nice with others. Well, I just gave it gratis and said it's a 10. After doing this for so many years, you know what works and what's not going to work. And the stability is 10. And my overall rating, I'd say for me, it was a 9 out of 10. I mean, I could take a few points off because we do say that this is based on our hardware and our own personal experience. And that touchpad, I mean, I could say a 7 out of 10 on it because I need to disable it. I just cannot stand having my mouse jump around like that. Final comments. I was pretty happy with my experience with Bunsen Labs, despite being biased towards OpenBox and Debian, I think it is a nicely assembled distro. Changing the installer to Calamars would help with the new user installation. People that are used to using a menuing system to find and open applications will adjust well. It would take some time getting used to not having a static place to move the mouse to access the menu. I know in past experiences with that workflow, it was always convenient to find the menu right where I clicked it at, so you don't have to go chase it down. For those of us that like the smacking the super key and typing in what we're looking for, that functionality is available. Using workspaces tends to be more of an advanced user feature, though I think it could be an easy way to organize open applications for a new user, because I think a lot of these things, if you show somebody how to use it, they'll understand how to use it and actually like it. You know, I think that some people don't give the new users enough credit for what they're actually able to do. They just don't know that they can't do that until they're shown how to do that. And I think this is especially on smaller screens, like Eric's tablet and I, when you get down into the 12-inch, 13-inch screens. If you're going to be alt-tabbing applications, you might as well just have them on different workspaces and do it that way. It's still the same finger action. Instead of doing alt-tab, like me, I do super 1, super 2, super 3 to go to my different workspaces. And you can also do the full screen applications, or in my Messenger apps, I'll split them 50-50, where half the screen is Telegram, half the screen is Discord. And I find that works pretty well. And especially for our aging eyes, I can see the text better. I was a bit surprised about the memory usage. Like I said, it was a bit high, even for OpenBox standards. I still think it would be okay with a computer that has 4 gigs or less of memory. Bunsen Labs is also very light on disk usage, because there wasn't a whole lot pre-installed that would take up a lot of space. And we have a new section on the podcast. It's feedback and errata. Moss mentioned in my review of Zorin OS 17 last episode that I failed to mention that it automatically checks the checksum before installation, which is a cool feature that only a few distros have. Further, I checked about the upgrade path, and it might work, but you have to pay Zorin 17 either way. If you have a valid invoice number for Zorin 16, you can get a 20% discount and no free lunch here. And he continues, I also found something interesting installing Debody 7.0 64-bit on his T540P, which is that the ISO does not include the Wi-Fi drivers for the ThinkPads. You will need to connect a laptop to Ethernet, then do your system updates. Then open the terminal and type sudo apt install firmware-iwlwifi and then reboot, at which point you will have working Wi-Fi. Thank you, Moss, for putting that in there. And yeah, it's been a long time since I've had to install that package. I mean, it's probably been 10 years since I've had at least 5 where that wasn't included by default. Announcements. For chatting with us further, you may choose to join our Telegram group, Discord channel, or email the show at distrohoppers@proton.me. Our website is https://distrohoppersdigest.org. And thanks again to Bill Hauser for doing the legwork and creating that for us. I am at Dale_CDL on Telegram, Discord. My email is also Dale_CDL@pm.me. And for Moss, you can hear him every week on Full Circle Weekly News. His email is bardmoss@pm.me. And he is on Mastodon at Zyvla@hosttux.social. Eric, take it away.
And you can hear more of me on other podcasts and streams like Mintcast, Linux OTC, Linux Saloon, and Linux Lugcast. I also have a YouTube channel at EricAdamsYT, and I can be reached on most social media and other chat platforms under my full name, Eric Adams. You can also reach me by email at eaonlinux@proton.me.
Before we go, we would like to thank all those who make this project possible.
Archive.org for storing and helping to distribute this program.
Audacity, which we use for recording and editing the show.
Tony Hughes for managing the website and Eric Adams for audio editing services.
Joshua Lowe for work on our logo.
All those who work on the teams which are creating, adapting, and maintaining the Linux distros we have reviewed this episode.
Mid-Air Machine, creators of the song Streets of Santivo, uses our music under Creative Commons license.
Thanks to Linus Torvalds for the kernel, Richard Stallman for the GNU toolkits, and all those who have worked behind the scenes on free and open source Libre software.
We'll be back next month, and thank all of you for listening.